Joined by our good friend Mike Leonard, Leonard Trial Lawyers. And Mike, it's always good to talk to you. How you doing on this Saturday?
John, great. Happy to be with you. Enjoying this amazing weather. A little hot, but what can we complain about, really? You know?
Yeah. Well, we got some storms downtown popping up here and there, Mike. But all in all, not too bad. I'll definitely take it. How's things going for you? You staying busy or you got a little lull in the schedule? I know you're always between trials or something's coming up.
Yeah, we got a couple short trials in August, but nothing that's real lengthy. But then once we start getting to September and the fall months and the rest of the year, we probably have something one or two a month for the rest of the year. So we'll be pretty busy. Feel like right now we're kind of in the motion writing and responding stage. Sometimes you get in the writing phase of the practice where you have to respond to a whole bunch of motions, and it seems like they always do at the same time. So doing a lot of that this summer as well.
How do you keep it all, like, how do you keep track of everything, right? There's different clients you have different trials coming up at different times, motions to set. Do you just like a giant whiteboard at home that looks like a conspiracy theories house? Like, how do you manage all these things?
I only have the whiteboard conspiracy theory board during the trial. I'm
right.
Seriously putting theories up there. But no, I mean, as an attorney, you get the calendar the heck out of everything. So you're always very cognizant of, you know, what's up in court that particular day in terms of status hearings, motion hearings, trials, all that sort of stuff. And when you're scheduling in court, when you're getting new dates, obviously you got to make sure you're scheduling around what you have. But sometimes that's not possible. And then you're just cognizant of dates where, you know, motions are due or responses to motions are due. And, you know, sometimes you have to go into the court for an extension on something. But it's really just vigorously calendaring, I say, is the key to success in terms of organization.
Right.
But yeah, there's always a lot going on at once. And that's part of the fun and part of the challenge of the practice.
Speaking of extensions, let's just get it out of the way. Talk a little bit about former President Trump's trial date extended, the federal one down in Florida. This would be the documents case. I guess that's probably the best way to say it. The Mar-a-Lago raid case, whatever you want to refer to it as. I had originally set a trial date. Well, originally it was like August or September. Then it was moved to December. Now it looks like it's going to be set for May. And a lot of people on both sides upset about this. People that want to see former President Trump in jail think that Judge Cannon is being ridiculous, pushing this trial back 5 months. People on the right are saying, well, boy, this is going to be after the primaries, right before the Republican National Convention. He's running for president. How can you do this? Where do you land on those two sides, Mike, this delay?
Well, the reality is that I thought the idea that it should go to trial in 2023 or really early 2024 is ludicrous. I mean, if you look at any federal criminal case, especially the one that has the sophisticated issues like that one does, as well as the voluminous documents and even things like getting lawyers and their staff clearance to look at documents, there's absolutely nothing unreasonable about the date that the judge has says set for trial. I actually think it's pretty quick. And, you know, most federal cases do not go to trial that quickly, especially at the level of this sophistication. So the idea that she's somehow aiding him or giving him a break with an early trial date, to me, makes absolutely no sense. And it's really contrary to reality. I think it's, if anything, an ambitious date. And, of course, you have to take into account all the political ramifications, and that's hard for a judge to kind of steer one way or another. But the date is extremely reasonable and fair, and I think probably should even be later in 2024. And that very well may happen. They may be back before the judge saying that this date's not realistic. And I think if people look at this in terms of other federal cases around the country, they'll see that the trial date is pretty ambitious to begin with.
Yeah, when you look at the mountain of evidence that prosecutors say they have, I mean, we're talking about days and days of security film to watch and like a million documents of discovery. And Mike, I got to know, is that one common? And number two is, how is anyone expected to read through a million pages of documents? You must have to hire a gigantic team to do that. I'm not trying to rise to former President Trump's defense, but I'm just saying, like, what? I mean, like, literally, you have a right to a defense, and you should be able to read through every document and understand what's happening. A million pages? That seems astronomical.
Yeah, it is crazy. And this is very typical in federal criminal cases. You know, on the one hand, the feds have a unique and distinct advantage that they typically investigate the cases for an extremely long period of time. Could be months, could be several years. And then all of a sudden, they indict the case. And on the defense lawyer, from the defense lawyer's perspective, all of a sudden you're getting, you know, week one, month one, you know, all sorts of discovery materials, which you've never had a chance to view, never been privy to. The government's been sitting on them for extended periods of time. And then when you get into the case, the federal rules oftentimes very much favor federal prosecutors in that they are not required to produce some of the materials, some key materials, such as some of the witness statements, some grand jury materials, until, well, you know, right on the eve of trial, so to speak, in a lot of jurisdictions. So, you know, it always creates a challenge, and it's very typical for the document production in federal cases to be crazily voluminous. The good part about that is, since the feds are sort of over thorough, they'll subpoena anything under the sun.
Right.
And of course, a lot of those productions, which could be, you know, dozens to hundreds of thousands to millions of pages, sometimes aren't particularly relevant, right?
Okay.
But in terms of, you know, coming up with a document review strategy, that's become really at the forefront of litigation, both in criminal cases and civil cases, with obligations put on litigants and parties by the courts, which results in oftentimes just crazy volumes of production. And the good thing is, you know, we're not in a total AI world yet. However, most lawyers now have to utilize the services of outside vendors who can load these documents, who can put them in a way that you can review them, you can search them. And so you can do what would have taken days, weeks, or months in the old days, and it might just be days or weeks, right?
Okay.
So those are huge benefits to people. But still, at the same time, you're still putting eyes on, you know, hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of pages, which, of course, inures to the benefit of the government, who's been sitting on these materials for a long time.
Right. So it's a little bit like when I read the book Moby Dick, and Herman Melville spent four chapters talking about how a schooner was built. I was able to skip that because that wasn't relevant to the story.
Wow, John, that is a good analogy. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
Well, there's also like 17 chapters about like what blubber is used for. And you could skip a little bit of that, too, if you need to.
Yeah. And oftentimes, you know, for instance, you may have a case where the government has subpoenaed social media records, email records, and they may get a time period, which is just crazy and has nothing to do with the case. And you can kind of hone in on the time period that really matters. However, you still got to be cognizant of everything that your client said or did in those other time periods, because certainly that could be brought up if relevant, or for, you know, to impeach the witness, to bring up other bad acts, to, you know, all sorts of reasons why you still have to have eyes on the rest of the production, even if it's not, you know, key or crucial to your initial review of those materials. But I like your Moby Dick analogy. And you're making yourself sound very well read, John.
Oh, right, yes, that freshman year read that we had to do. Maybe it was later than that. Maybe it was in college. I don't remember, but I remember being like, I'm going to skim through this part. Just to recap, I just want to, for people just joining us, Mike Leonard commented just a little bit ago that the date that Judge Aileen Cannon set for in May, there seemed to be nothing squirrely about that date. I know a lot of people seem to be upset that it was pushed back. And look, this is me getting on my, like, on the side. Let's say you hate former President Trump and you think he deserves to go to jail, and that's your opinion. Okay, you should want this to play out as favorable or at least as by the book as possible to avoid any sense of impropriety. I didn't see anything wrong with pushing the trial back to May. Yes, it may be inconvenient on a political calendar, and certainly the right is going to argue that. But in terms of just if this is any old defendant and that's the standard we're applying, as Mike Leonard's even saying, that might be a little bit quicker than some federal trials go to or federal cases go to trial. Okay, Mike, I want to ask you one more question about President Trump. You saw the former President Trump. You saw the letter, or he truth socialed out that he got a letter from Jack Smith saying that he could appear before this grand jury in Washington, D.C. related to a January 6th case. I know a lot of people have surmised that this has been in the works for some time and an indictment can be coming. What is it about giving the president a chance to testify before a grand jury? Is that typical? Is that like a last step that a prosecutor might give to a possible defendant, future defendant?
Yeah, it's a tool that's often used, but, you know, certainly in a case like this, with the notoriety of the defendant and the publicness of the investigation, that's why they're doing it. Although defendants in federal criminal matters, investigations, you know, on a regular basis get target letters, but it's not certainly not the norm, right? But it really is somewhat of a joke. I mean, it's basically a prosecutor saying, hey, look, we've targeted you, which they already knew already, right? And it's kind of an invitation to appear, which no one would ever take up, okay? There's really nothing in it for the former president, or for that matter, any defendant to appear before a grand jury and be subject to essentially limitless cross-examination by the prosecution team lawyers, and no ability to have your own lawyer ask you any questions. So
right.
It's an invitation he'll never accept.
Right.
But it's sort of a courtesy, like, hey, we gave him a chance to tell his story to the grand jury, but no one would ever take that invitation up. You know, one in a million potential defendants would actually appear before a grand jury and put themselves, so that makes no sense. You're
no
making
sense.
Statements against yourself, which are probably going to be used to charge you or going to be used against you at the trial.
Do you feel like that this could mean that there's an indictment? Is it like a slam dunk that something's coming, or could this still not happen that way?
Well, I'd be pretty shocked if there wasn't an indictment. I don't think they would take this step of making the offer and telling him point blank that he's a target without probably a pretty clear intention that they're attempting to get an indictment. So certainly they're going to ask for an indictment, and certainly they will get one if that's what they choose to do, because as we know, it's a one-sided completely presentation of the so-called evidence against the defendant. So I would expect that the January 6th investigation will result in criminal charges against former President Trump. I think that's probably a done deal.
And just to recap what you just said there, it's a one-sided argument. We've talked about this before. These are the prosecutors going to, yes, a grand jury essentially of your peers in theory, but it doesn't hold the weight, of course, of a trial because there's no defense.
Correct. So basically, you know, you go before the grand jury if you chose to do that, and you'd be testifying. And then, of course, remember, the grand jury is not deciding your guilt or innocence. They're just deciding whether there's enough to charge you with an offense, right? Which is a very low, minimal burden. And, of course, it's very difficult to withstand cross-examination under those circumstances, really any circumstances. So, of course, as the old saying goes, you can indict a ham sandwich because you get to present these folks with whatever evidence you want. You can exclude whatever you want. You can include whatever you want. And so, therefore, if your goal is to get an indictment, it's very likely that's going to happen.
Right. All right. I'm going to pivot here. We'll talk a little bit about the Safety Act with Michael Leonard and some other things with Mike. LeonardTrialLawyers.com. Mike, who should be reaching out to you, and what should they be calling you about?
Well, John, great books, readers like yourselves, of course, but then also people who are facing federal or state criminal charges, either going to trial or being investigated. And then, of course, on the civil side, we regularly take cases to trial on behalf of whistleblowers. So those are kind of our areas of expertise.
Mike Leonard, who has a great record of not guilty verdicts in federal court. Mike, that's pretty rare, huh?
It is. It's tough to get the not guilty against the feds because, as we kind of were talking about earlier, they spend so much time investigating these cases that when they make a charging decision, they spent months or years gathering evidence against you. So, yeah, it's tough to get the not guilty. When you do, it's extremely satisfying for your client as well as you. And let's face it, John, it's fun to beat the feds, isn't it?
No comment. But you like you like fighting against the man. That is, I think, Mike Leonard's biggest statement of support I think I could give you from a lot of people and a lot of work that you do. Okay, the Safety Act, I think, I don't know. I don't know where you read the tea leaves on the oral arguments or if you even had a chance to listen to them, but the Supreme Court 5-2 ruled that it can go into effect. Any thoughts on that? I know we talked about it before it actually, when it was passed, but before it was implemented, and then we talked about this delay. Your thoughts, Mike?
Yeah, I thought it was a decision that was expected from the Illinois Supreme Court. And just to remind the listeners, the Safety Act was an initiative, Illinois kind of being at the forefront of this effort to eliminate cash bail because of the unfairness and inequities that it causes. And it causes people who may be similarly situated from somebody else in terms of the charge that they're facing, but may not have the monetary resources to get out of jail pending trial, and may sit in Cook County Jail or some other county jail from anywhere from months to 5 years. You know, there's a recent Tribune story about this and how behind Cook County is. So I think it's a great decision by the Illinois Supreme Court. It's one that I expected. And what's going to happen now, John, is beginning in September, when the act goes into effect, there'll be a lot of motions for rehearing on bail bond that's been set, you know, months or years ago. So there'll be a lot of people who will be eligible for release and who will appropriately get released. The act still allows certain people to be detained under certain circumstances for certain crimes. So it doesn't mean that the jails will be emptied, but it'll really change the stakes in terms of people's ability to get out, earn a living, be with their family, and do all those things, and prepare for trial and meet with their lawyers more effectively and appropriately leading up to the trial of the case.
Right. Yeah, and we've talked about Safety Act so much till we're like blue in the face here on the station, because people are legitimately fired up about it on both sides. And we talked a little bit about this on the Mincing Rascals this week, if anyone wants to download that podcast. It's interesting, right? Like, we're talking in a lot of cases, in most cases, I mean, these people haven't been found guilty of anything. And normally, as Americans, we rally to the defense of, hey, you are innocent in this country until proven guilty. And I think obviously there's certain cases where it makes no sense to let someone out with what they're accused of is poses a danger to society. And without a doubt, someone will be released because of this, or someone will be released and there's going to be a crime committed and this is going to put this whole law into the spotlight. But let's not forget that's already happening here today as well. I don't know where I'm going with this, Mike, but I guess what I ultimately wanted to ask was, and you touched on this, can you talk a little bit about the difference being able to talk to a client when they are not in jail and prepare for an adequate defense versus when they are in prison or jail?
Well, it's so much easier and more effective. I mean, to be able to have your client come down to your office on a schedule, to be able to go to see them, to have them be going about their lives in terms of work and their family life versus trying to get into a jail, trying to bring documents into a jail, trying to get over there as often as you can, and often enough, quite frankly, it's difficult. So it's just a sea change. So it's very difficult. And also what it does practically, it wears people down. Okay. So prosecutors, I think, you know, amongst other reasons, they know whether they'll admit it or not, it wears defendants down. It makes them less likely to plead guilty. It makes them less likely to take a deal, so to speak, because your will is worn down being incarcerated on a case for a year, 2 years. And then sometimes you do so much time, John, that the deal they're offering you will get you out quickly. And it doesn't take into account the fact you've already done all this time for something you haven't been found guilty of. So I think it's a great advance, but clearly it's going to be controversial. There will be instances where someone who's out, who didn't remain in custody, may commit another crime. And of course, that'll be an ongoing debate, but that happens already in all of our systems around the country already. That happens from time to time, of course.
We have a texture with the 773 regarding the Safety Act, wondering if we should basically, should we hold judges to the fire a little bit? Should we move this process along so that trials happen a little bit quicker? Like, isn't there a right to a speedy trial for someone who is a defendant, right? Like, maybe the texts are saying, let's not necessarily let them all out of prison with no cash bail, but why don't we move up trial dates a little bit quicker?
Well, yeah, there's all sorts of problems. So there's not one culprit. You know, there's issues from getting the discovered materials in a timely way. That's becoming more electronic-sized. That's probably not a word, right? More electronic, you know, to pushing cases on the docket, to moving dockets. It's not just in the hands of a judge who makes the decision when the trial is going to be. The defendant and the defense lawyer has to be ready. He has to demand trial. He has to fit a trial in around his or her schedule. So there's 100 different factors that go in on the trial date. But I agree with you. We need to get cases tried quicker. We need to get cases adjudicated, whether it's a plea or trial, quicker. And I think there's a lot of pressure on counties like Cook to make that happen.
Mike Leonard agreeing with the 773. I like that. Mike, what number can people reach you at, by the way?
312-380-6559 is my work direct dial, John.
LeonardTrialLawyers.com, 312-380-6559. I'm not letting you go. I got Tim from Arlington Heights who's got a question, but hopefully, Tim, you can hang on till after the news because we're going to talk a little bit about whistleblowers with Mike Leonard. And Mike, you'll be pleased to know that on the text line, I've been called full MAGA and a liberal, a full bleeding liberal, on the same hour. How about that, Mike? We did it.
That's That just shows how open-minded you are, John. You know? Wow.
There we go. That's always a badge of honor that I wear. A quick break, then news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.
Now, here's John Hanson, and let's get legal.
At 210 on WGN. Yeah, we'll continue our conversation here with Mike Leonard from Leonard Trial Lawyers. And Mike, and a lot of comments on the line about the Safety Act. Someone wants to know, but what about the stats about people who were killed or injured by individuals let out on bail or electronic monitoring? And I guess, Mike, my only answer to that is, well, this doesn't affect those people because if they're already being let out on bail, that has nothing to do with the current situation, right? Because I think that's the confusing part about the act that a lot of people, maybe they do grasp, but I'm just not giving them credit for, and they have legitimate arguments about it. But these are about people that can't be let out of bail because they simply do not have the money to do so for relatively minor crimes, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it certainly is. It's much broader than that. It's much broader than just a subset of people with relatively minor crimes.
True.
But there are protections in the act that still give the judge discretion as to certain categories of offenses to have the person detained if they find, to make a finding that they're a flight risk or they're a danger to the community in terms of being violent. So there are safeguards in the act. But look, nothing's perfect, and there's no question that, you know, if more people are going to be out, there's going to be a statistical possibility that, you know, someone who's out might commit a crime. We can't eliminate that. That's never going to happen. We don't have a perfect system.
Right.
But I think it's a pretty good one. And I think it is addressing the issue of people who would otherwise be let out, who just don't have the financial resources to do it. Typically, they're not considered what the courts would be consider a flight risk or a danger to the community. So hopefully we'll have a lot of success under the system. But clearly it's not perfect.
No, it isn't. And there's more in the Safety Act than just the cash bail thing, right? And a lot of it, a lot of people disagree with, including sheriffs, et cetera. And that's a worthy debate to have. I guess at the end of the day, the one part that I care about and think makes sense to me, that if someone gets caught shoplifting or has a DUI or is alleged to have committed a DUI, again, they're not found guilty of any of this stuff yet. If one person can pay $5,000 because they have it or their family can have it, how is that fair to let them go on bond but not someone that can't? So that person has to sit detained for months waiting for the trial to happen. I just like that, and it's
exactly.
Very basic sense makes
more,
no sense.
More commonly years. Yeah. So
years.
You know, yeah, I think it's a great point. Yeah, I think it's a great point. But we're gonna get, it's not something that's universally approved.
Right.
Certainly it's not being done universally across the United States, but I think it's an important step here, and I'm glad we're taking it. There's going to be a body of data as we go forward that we can talk about.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And people can debate it, right? And the fact that the act doesn't just address the one situation I came up with, of course, makes things more complicated. But I appreciate everyone's feedback on it, and that's what we have here in a democracy, and the legislature can go back and change it. Okay, Mike, I want to get to a question Tim has, because I know you help out whistleblowers, okay?
Sure.
All right, Tim in Arlington Heights, thanks for holding, bud. What is your question?
Hi. My question is about protection for whistleblowers. You know, thinking about the Hunter Biden case, those guys work for the government, I believe. But even in just more generally, how are whistleblowers protected from blowback or even, you know, employment discrimination if they do step up?
Okay. Mike, whether it's reference to the Hunter Biden situation or, you know, just generally whistleblowers in general, they deserve certain protections, right? I guess. Talk us through how your take on that.
Sure. Great question by Tim, and we appreciate that. And it's a question that comes up from clients all the time. So I'll take kind of the two common scenarios. So in Illinois, there's a whistleblower cause of action, you know, a legal claim where you report to your employer that they're violating the law in some way. And the protection there is that if you are fired, if they take a material change against you, you have a claim against them. You can sue them for retaliation. Some people think, well, that's not so great because I'm already fired. But yes, you can sue them for retaliation. So but that's one important protection. The other protection, which is bigger and which is more common, a lot of the whistleblower cases we handle, and percentage-wise, whistleblower cases in the country arise either under federal law or state law under what's called the False Claims Act. And there's basically a False Claims Act for federal court and one for state court, right? And one of the most important protections of that is that you can be a whistleblower and file the lawsuit. However, it stays under seal, meaning it's secret. Nobody knows about it except for the government, you, while the government investigates the case. So you could continue to be an employee of that company for the duration of the investigation. No one even know that you'd filed it, and the government can go about doing its work to investigate. So those are some of the basic important protections, but it's a question that comes up all the time. And to give it some context, you know, there's also the practical blowback. I mean, I remember vividly representing a couple who was based in Florida who were whistleblowers. And when the case hit the press, they came into work the next day. Their colleagues, who they viewed as friends, you know, had been to each other's homes, things of that nature, were sitting at their paper, and no one would speak to them. So, you know, there is some blowback in being a whistleblower and coming forward and blowing the whistle on an employer or the government. And sometimes that's part of the equation, but it's part of the principle, the reason why people do it. People do it because they're also rewarded financially, but a lot of people do it because the principal reason they think there's something wrong, and they have the backbone to stand up. But it's a difficult calculus for a lot of people.
Right. And federal employees, like whether they work for the IRS or other things, that's a whole other ballgame, right? Like, I mean, they fear reprisal by their bosses, I guess. That's a legitimate fear. I don't know what sort of protections they have as federal employees. Do you, Mike?
Well, sure. You're always, I mean, any whistleblower is always worried about reprisal. If they're going to stay with the company, they're worried, am I going to get fired, right? The law absolutely protects them in that respect. But look, you can still get fired, and then you're going to have to litigate a case
right.
for that wrongful firing that's in retaliation for being a whistleblower. Some people think that's not enough. But, you know, there's only so much you can do to protect everybody, but that's certainly an important mechanism to guard against retaliation.
Someone brought up a great point on the 847. What if a boss at your job makes the whistleblower's life miserable by giving you dreadful assignments? Then what are you to do? I guess we'd call Patrick Dolan, wouldn't we, Mike?
I think we would. I think, if it's a pure whistleblower case, they'll call me. Otherwise, they'll call Patrick every day of the week.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, that's another practical concern. You know, you blow the whistle internally about a violation of law, and of course, your fear is, hey, my boss is going to do this or do that to me. And obviously, your relief is to the courts, or if you haven't been fired, your relief is to HR. And let's face it, sometimes that's not enough, and it doesn't give you enough protection. But those are the outlets that you have.
I want to see you and Patrick Dolan team up on a case together. That'd be fun to watch.
I'd love it. That would be a blast.
Patrick Dolan of Conti and Dolan, a frequent guest of this show. Before I let you go, Mike, I wanted to talk to you about, we've chatted a lot on WGN generally, of course, about what happened at Northwestern in the past couple weeks with the athletes and the hazing. What are your two cents on that, especially as it relates to, you know, hazing laws here in Illinois?
Yeah, we do have, to many people's surprise, there is a hazing law in the books. It's not used very often. I think quick peek at today, I think it was on books beginning in 1990, which does, you know, make criminalize hazing, which defines as induction into an organization such as a university, et cetera, et cetera. It makes it a misdemeanor, and it requires some physical harm. However, it also makes it a class 4 felony if it results in death, the hazing results in death or great bodily injury. So there is something on the books that can be used criminally in a hazing situation. It's not used very often. With regard to the Northwestern situation, I'd be shocked if it was used. I mean, I don't know that we have any allegations of bodily harm to anybody or physical harm. Clearly, mental anguish, we know that's a factor that people have talked about. But I wouldn't expect any prosecutions to arise out of this.
You're talking about prosecution against players or specific coaches.
Correct.
in a criminal way.
Yeah, really. Yeah, you really have to. You'd have to charge an individual or a coach, and you'd have to prove that they engaged in the conduct, they did it intentionally, and that some sort of physical harm resulted. So, I doubt there's going to be a prosecution, and certainly some of the hazing that's been talked about is from a long time ago, it may even be barred by the applicable statute of limitations. But there is a law in the book that could be used. I just don't expect it to happen. But, hey, I've been wrong before, John, once or twice on your show.
Yeah, not too often, though, Mike. Hey, we got one more texter about the Safety Act who was a little upset I didn't ask you this question. So I wanted to just give it one more chance. They wanted to know how many Illinois County District Attorneys support the Safety Act. I don't have the number off the top of my head, but I think two out of every three, or maybe it's more than that, did not support the Safety Act. It's an overwhelming number of district attorneys or special attorneys did not support the Safety Act. But Mike, I wonder your thoughts on that. If they don't make the laws, right? Like I get why they wouldn't support it.
Yeah, and that's why it's important that the legislature passes the laws. And of course, there's going to be actors in the system who are going to either support or not support the act. But yeah, there were a number of state attorneys from various counties who opposed it. That didn't surprise me. Law enforcement would rather have people in custody. Prosecutors would rather have people in custody. I get it. That's part of their job in the system. But with an act like this, you have the legislature to weigh in and define what's appropriate, what the law should be. And so they have every right to voice their opinion. But the Illinois Supreme Court has now ruled, and certainly they will be complying with that law. But I agree. Yeah, there was a lot of opposition from law enforcement because they want to see people detained. That's what they do. And that's typically what they ask for. So that didn't surprise me.
Yeah. And for some bona fide reasons, too. And there were actually changes made to the act after a lot of people voiced their opinion. And I think that's an important part of this, too, is that we take opinions from all sides and we try and figure out a solution that works for now. And if it doesn't work or there's elements that need to be changed after this goes into effect, we do that, too. And we listen to people's opinions on both sides of this. Mike, I got to let you go. Yeah. I really appreciate your time, though, my friend.
Hey, John, thanks a lot. I could answer that last question, but we don't have time, John, but I appreciate being on your show as always.
312-380-6559 is how you reach Mike Leonard, leonard@triallawyers.com. Have a good rest of your weekend, Mike.
Appreciate it, John. Take care.